December 6th Clean Water Commission meeting will start. We'll do the roll call. Holly?
Present.
Brendan?
Here.
Jeremy?
Here.
Michelle?
Here.
David?
Here.
Dip?
Absent.
He emailed, I don't know if he saw that, but he did email that.
Oh. Mark?
Here.
And Jeff?
And he also emailed.
All right, we have four. And I am present, Raylon. So let's take a minute, look at our packet, and review the minutes from last time. We haven't had the opportunity.
And you should be able to see it on the video screen in a moment. Okay. So we've been working on an update of the Clean Water Program fee reduction for schools. So I don't know if you're aware that the schools have, any schools in unincorporated Clark County have the opportunity to apply for a reduction in their clean water program fee. So county staff from Public Works and Public Health have been working together to update the criteria that the schools need to meet so that they can actually receive a reduction. And we've also worked with representatives from the two active school districts who are currently seeking a fee reduction in this year. That's Vancouver School District and Evergreen School District. And so here's the updated criteria. To be eligible, for a school to be eligible to receive a 100% clean water program fee reduction on a school-by-school basis, they need to complete all four of these tasks, and I will now, and there's also going to be documentation that is will be associated with each of these tasks that will have to be turned in by a certain time period, and I'm going to go through each of the tasks or criteria. So the first one is a stormwater best management practices training. So the school districts need to have all school staff whose daily activities could have the potential to pollute stormwater attend a training that is put on by a Clark County Clean Water Division staff person. And the training will cover the effective use and implementation of operational and structural BMPs. So basically, making sure to protect stormwater from any kind of maintenance or custodial work that could be done. So educating the staff is one key component. The other is stormwater facility inspection. This already happens in our program. Any private and public stormwater facility in the county, which we talked about last time, is inspected by Clark County staff, or nearly every single one. And any identified deficiencies need to be corrected within 6 months, which is what our code stipulates, so we're not diverging from, our requirement isn't diverging at all from that. Task number three is, and this is really where the update, the changes from what we have been doing in the past, is there's now going to be a menu of educational programs that a school can be participating in, and they just need to implement one educational activity that provides students with an understanding of human activities and land use practices that create surface and or stormwater problems. So, I mean, this is kind of the meat of it, and really actually the overarching theme, which is we have this opportunity in the schools to educate students who will be our future citizens, I mean, and they're our current citizens, about stormwater and how to protect our watersheds from pollutants. And so using this opportunity to then give back to the schools if they can show us that they're actually educating the students, it's kind of a win-win for both the schools and for the county.
Absolutely. So Washington, I know Washington has one of the best implemented green schools program in all the states.
Yeah.
How does that kind of converge with this? Is it a separate program? So like if they're already on a green schools program and they have these activities, you know, checked off, because they do keep a yearly annual thing of everything that the schools do.
Right.
Does that count towards this?
Yes. So that's kind of how this has changed. So in the past, we only were working with Washington Green School certification. And now we're opening it up to some other options. But Washington Green School certification in either water or school grounds is one way to implement, is one educational program that they can do. But they need to, within that year, actually complete an audit and do a project of lasting change. But then the other options that they can do is they can also, like, help the school club as a green team. But now we can open up, too, to field trips to, like, the Water Resources Center, Clark Public Utilities, and Columbia Springs. And the one thing, too, is that, so Eric is a big part of this, the educational component. He's looked at and talked with a lot of these different providers or educational opportunities to looking at their curriculum and whether it actually fits. So not everything that all of these organizations offer fits and really is educating about stormwater. So we're if a school is interested, then we have informational sheets to give them that then in more depth can say which programs are would actually qualify.
Now, are the schools being made aware and think that they qualify for a reduction in seawater, what they have to do, or is that something that we have to take?
Yeah, so that this is, so that, like, this actually us presenting here is one way to publicly announce it. And Vancouver School Districts and Evergreen School Districts, they are aware, and they know, and we've actually talked to them about and gotten some feedback about these changing, these different criteria, and they are actually pretty excited about it, I think. And then it's just kind of, And it's any school in unincorporated Clark County. So school districts might have schools both in cities and in the county, but our fee, because this Clark County's clean water fee, only applies to Clark County schools. So that's all our program covers. So we also have some of the other opportunities would be the Student Water Quality Monitoring Network, and that includes the Student Watershed Congress that happens in the spring. There's a Salmon in the Classroom. There's also Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership. They've got a number of field programs as well as field education kits. And then even Clark County, Jane Tessner-Kleiner of our education and outreach, she's developed some student activity sheets. So those could be teacher implemented. And then basically the documentation that we have come up with will, at the end of the day, really it's about tell us what you've done, help us understand that you've actually achieved educating students, and making the case. And there's certainly the opportunity to also not go off of one of the listed activities, but then really we would like it if the school would come to us with their idea beforehand, and certainly before the very end of the year at the last minute, to make sure that that would be an approved program. But we're certainly open to that.
Do any of these educational programs involve parents as well?
Yeah, a lot of them do have an opportunity for parent involvement as volunteers. And I think sometimes, like school green teams, sometimes it's a parent that leads it, sometimes it's not staff. My understanding is that teachers are another reason why we wanted to do is start opening up what schools are already doing. And when we were only looking at Washington Green School certification, it's a great program, but it also has a lot of requirements, and sometimes it's difficult to do in 1 year. It's also that not every school can have the resources to devote, the time resources to devote to it. And then the other thing, too, is that some of these other programs as well is that Clark County is actually is helping fund them. So it's another part of that feedback loop of encouraging more participation. And a lot of schools are already involved in a lot of these programs, so now they can get a benefit from it. And then the last task or criteria is that they need to do a community activity that disseminates the stormwater message. And focusing on something, lessons learned or experiences from the educational program. And I mean, it's the ideas that Eric has come forward with are display art projects or a family watershed science festival, a landscape feature, a newsletter or a new publication specifically about the projects, a school assembly or presentation, a school assembly with a presentation or a performance, or like a school outreach event. But once again, this is another one of those that we would be open to other ideas, but we would want to, if the school is wanting to do something different, to come to us for approval ahead of time. And so then the timeline. So the school year, we are wanting to implement this as of this school year that has already started. And so this is where it gets complicated, because your school year will cross 2017 and 2018. However, it's only going to deal with reducing the fee in the calendar year of 2018. Because the fees are calendar year, they're not school year, and it really is crossing two calendar years. So, we've made it so that everything kind of lines up, that we're going to, by the end of the school year in June, then there gives a little bit of time, a little bit of downtime, and then all the documentation that we're going to want needs to be turned into us by July 15th, but certainly any time before that would be wonderful as well. And then that gives time to then start working through fee reductions before the second half statement goes out, tax statement goes out.
So they would be applying each year?
Yeah, they need to be actively documenting each year.
So the requirement, like, you know, training for staff, they have to make sure that staff is getting that training?
Yeah, they need to get that training every year. And within within the school year parameter, basically. I mean, we didn't put this on here, but really, I mean, July 17, you know, if they ended up doing the training in July of 2017, that would still probably be fine because it's kind of crossing over. But once we've jumped into actually rolling this out year by year, it should then start to flow and make sense. So we've had... our Vancouver School District, they've done their training. They gather all their staff together and do one big training. And they hit a lot of different disciplines. And so Bob Patterson in our division, he presented there. And so that's it. If you need more information or anybody, Eric.
How much of a decrease is it?
So it's 100%. They would not have to pay their clean water fee at all for the school, for each school.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So thank you.
Is this just direct to you guys?
Yeah, basically direct to either Eric or me.
All right.
Any questions? Any?
So then will this slide deck be posted somewhere?
Yeah, actually, we will then be posting it on the website, on our Clean Water Commission website under the meets at the minutes, and then really it'll be on the other side, which would be presentations or meetings.
So perhaps, like, if you have children in a certain county, it would be kind of up to us to go see, you know, if the school is involved, check out a particular school, talk to the staff, the ladies at the front desk, and just kind of see if they know if they're involved.
Yeah.
Thing, and then just kind of get the ball rolling independently as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely, it's certainly, I would imagine, a good way to encourage, and find out what's going on in your school. And sometimes it's one or two teachers. I haven't been involved that much on the school interface end as much, so I can't totally speak to it as well.
I was going to say, having done the watershed monitoring program with one of the educators,
okay.
Really, the school's involvement is based a lot on a couple of personalities in the school. So
yeah.
If there's one or two teachers that are really into it, they'll carry it. So finding that, those people are there.
And I've heard that can sometimes be difficult then if that staff person leaves, and then it's hard to get ramped back up or get re-energized.
And I think that's part of the reason why we wanted to open up the flexibility a little bit, where it was all focused on Washington Green Schools, which again is a great program, but you know, a lot of these programs are things that can come to the teachers and come into the schools, which, you know, allows for that type of education, which otherwise might have been time prohibitive or, you know, another barrier. And I think also to mention, I think Hockenson School District is also aware of it. They haven't reached out to for more information yet.
Yes, the question I have is, who the personality on staff that's going to be most interested in being where that you're going to want the teacher to talk to from that point? Would that be the principals? Who is it going to be the most?
Well, it ends up being, and we've definitely talked about this, that that's where it gets, sometimes it's more administrators, but it could be principal. And that's why it makes me wonder, too, like if Holly asks at the office or one teacher, they may or may not know about it. It makes me wonder, like, if it's something that everyone in the school will know about. So you might have to keep asking and just kind of see.
At that point, it would be up to the schools to decide where that money goes, right? Do we all get it?
No. So because my little bit of understanding of how schools are done, I mean, so it's really administration. They're paying the, you know, any taxes and fees on property that they own, and that's really where that comes out of. So, and I certainly can't speak to what a school does, but that there could be a disconnect of that.
You know, there are, excuse me, statewide science teacher associations that identify people who are interested and people who join them. It's not just every science teacher at every school. It's people who are really interested in doing innovative things. That might be one way to identify contacts at the different schools.
That's a great idea. I didn't even think about that.
Thank you.
Sure.
One other question, and this might be, I don't know whether this goes in yours or in Eric's upcoming one, but maybe there's a way to feature some of these projects in years down the road in, you know, the grant stuff for the education as an example, as a model, or on the tour or whatever.
Yeah, that would be really neat, for sure.
Video.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Always make a great story, that's for sure. Okay, well, let's see, in the past, I think the last meeting we talked a little bit about the Downspout Disconnect program, which we're going to be ramping up. That's been a real learning experience for everyone in the office. To date, we've had about 65 applicants. I
had gone on nearly 40 visits, site visits, have 4 completed projects, and we've raised a ton of awareness. We put in about $100 in a couple different advertising campaigns on Facebook, where we got more than 7,000 impressions about people seeing the ad, basically the Facebook post, and through that, over 1,100 people click on our website, staying there for an average of 5 minutes. Which, if you've ever dug into Google Analytics, that's a great achievement. Yeah. So people are definitely understanding that the volume of water coming off these urbanized spaces and impervious surfaces is a big deal and something that we should be concerned with. We've seen a lot, getting on the ground and visiting these homes has been an incredible experience for myself. I've probably seen at least about 30 of them, and really learned a lot about, what people know about stormwater, what some of their motivations are, and also, what their landscape is like and how suitable it is or isn't for disconnecting a downspout. One of the things that I think we've learned that's been, most surprising is that a lot of these homes that were built with the weed pole and the curb, basically to have their stormwater pipe spray off the curbs, they don't see water coming out that curb anymore. So what we're actually finding is perhaps a lot of these structures that were built are broken in the ground, already doing what we kind of want them to do now, which was an interesting finding. And I think that, it's been really interesting too. I thought that, truth be told, I thought we'd have more projects completed by now. So finding out why people, maybe it's during the summer that everybody's busy, or maybe they just don't feel like they have time for it, or they don't want to do it for whatever reason, or maybe, who really knows? We've been trying to follow up and get a feel for that, but I expect to have more projects completed, but I really am proud of the amount of awareness that we've raised in the community and getting out there and, getting people to talk to their neighbors about it too. I think it's been a real victory in that sense. And again, it's a pilot project, so I think coming up in the next couple weeks, we're going to be having a meeting with Jeff and Dean and Jane and myself, just to kind of talk about where we are with the pilot project so far, to see about how we move forward with it. So let's see what else. We've also, that other grant that we got from Clean Water Restoration Fund for the Friends of Trees, Urban Tree Canopy, the next planting event is December 9th, and we're going to be planting around the Hazel Avenue corridor. And so this planting event, unlike the one we did in the spring, is going to be focused more on planting along Hazeldale Ave and public spaces, public right-of-ways, and also potentially around some parks that border streets, and also private businesses and some multifamily housing units as well. So it's not quite the same where last one in the spring, we reached out to a bunch of homeowners door-to-door canvassing to try to get homeowners to say they want trees. But this one, we're going to do a little bit of a different approach. I think the following spring we'll be doing more of the homeowner type outreach again. But this one is more, again, multifamily homes, private businesses, and along some public street corridors. So, that'll be December 9th again. And some upcoming events before I get into some stormwater partner stuff. September 23rd, we'll be working with Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership. They're going to be hosting a paddle picnic and pickup at Vancouver Lake, where I believe all of the paddling trips are already booked up. So that's full. And I think there's still some opportunities to join some of the pickups. There'll be some litter pickup, I think 2 litter pickups during that day. And they're also hosting a picnic too. So that'll be a good opportunity where the Clean Water Division can have some outreach space at that event, as well as just having LSEP come in there and do some of the great work that they already do so well.
Which day did you say that was there?
That is the 23rd of September. Yeah, it's at Vancouver Lake Regional Park. And the following week, on the 28th and the 29th, Columbia Springs puts together Columbia River Watershed Festival, and there'll be a bunch of green programs that come in and host events for a bunch of elementary school students who come for 2 days on the 28th and the 29th, it's a Thursday and Friday, to learn about different green initiatives. And we'll be partnering with the City of Vancouver to be hosting like a scavenger hunt nature tour around that area, looking at different native plants and non-native plants, and yeah, just helping the kids and kind of showing them the good, the bad, and the ugly, and what they can do to help make things better. And then we've also been getting some work groups together with the Stormwater Partners because we're trying to get in a couple of gross grants from Department of College. That's a grant of regional or statewide significance. That's the acronym for GROSS. And they often fund these social marketing education outreach campaigns. I think the last one they've thrown a bit of money to is the Don't Trip and Drive program up in the Puget Sound. And so at the last Stormwater Partners meeting, I think I mentioned this at the last meeting, we had discussed that the Don't Trip and Drive campaign would be a good thing for Stormwater Partners to be able to kick off and implement. And so we're going to be writing a grant proposal with that, for that, the Department of Ecology for the GROSS grant, and hoping that Vancouver, or I believe their name is now the Watershed Alliance, will be helping with the implementation to run some leak check events. Now, for that, those GROSS grants, they really also want to see an element that's new. It's a competitive grant, no matching required. So they have been funding the Don't Trip and Drive in Puget Sound through three phases. And so we're trying to incorporate in the new Don't Trip and Drive a couple of new elements. One of them is outreach to multifamily housing units, where some people mentioned that maybe that's where they see more leaky cars and more drips, whereas the Puget Sound campaign really focused on, I believe, income earners of $50,000 or more. So we're going to possibly try some outreach multifamily housing, and also we'd like to add a business outreach component to help with sustainability for the program. Because right now, you know, we've got, yes.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but I was going to ask you about that. There was a large corporation in a paper, I was going to bring it in after, I'm sorry, but they're looking at doing a very large revamp. They have to redo all these services on the outside, a lot of the funding that's going, so there's there being a lot of inspectors. I know there was somebody from our department that was possibly going to be there, but I thought it might be a great opportunity instead of just repaving, you know, and they're going to add more, you know, paving surfaces to this, you know, very large section. It's a very big part of Vancouver. It might be an opportunity to just, you know, because there's a lot of great products out there as opposed to just using, you know, laying down cement.
Yeah.
So there, yeah, I know it's open for. I'm not quite sure. I'll have to get that and bring to you, but
yeah,
I thought it might be a great opportunity to just, you know, start with the corporation.
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing that's kind of missing from the Don't Trip and Drive campaign, the Puget Sound, is an element of sustainability.
Right.
You know, ecology can throw a bunch of money at it, but then once that stops, the program just kind of dwindles out. And so we'd like to see some involvement with the business community, whether it's something that they can host a leak check event to help their own. Your own employees, you know, obviously it does maintain the lifetime of their paved surfaces as well, preventing drips, and obviously shows a level of stewardship on their behalf. And so that's the Don't Trip and Drive campaign that we'll be applying for.
I'm wondering what their thinking was when they ended up having an income.
Yeah.
50,000, were they thinking that people that make that kind of income or more will be able to pay for and repair their vehicles as opposed to something else. And if we were extending the program to people that made less, maybe it would be interesting to try to involve some of the repair shop community to assist, maybe even give them a 15%, 20%, 25% discount to get it repaired in the event that they have leaks, because the people with low incomes are more likely to have cars that drift, in my humble opinion, and not take care of it. And what we're really after is to try again to take care of it, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, they didn't explicitly say that, but they did a lot of market research in the Puget Sound efforts so far, and I think that they came to that rough income level as part of their identifying their target market and our target audience, rather. And so I think that, they did offer a coupon of 10% off of the repair up to $50. And one of the things they did talk about in some of the reports was experimenting with some different levels of discounting. And I believe the way it works now is that the auto shop will actually just do that, take it off themselves, give them that discount, kind of in exchange for a campaign that gets people in to the shop to address a problem that they may not have otherwise.
In the alternative, what about doing a program for the do-it-yourself auto people that may have lower income and having a second inspection to demonstrate that they actually took care of it? Maybe that might be another possible new way to meet your requirements for the grant.
Clarification on that part, though, was it not that they're not having people have to prove, make 50,000 more, that I'm eligible for it? That was just what they were focusing their resources on, marketing.
Exactly. So they were, that was just kind of, I guess, the number that they came up with. Just like David had said, speculated that, people living in the Puget Sound, I'm not sure how they did the market research, but we're thinking that people that make $50,000 or more are more likely to have resources to repair their leaks, and so let's focus on this for the pilot project that we're doing. So, we put together another work group for another popular idea at the last Stormwater Partners meeting, which was Stormwater Facilities Education and Outreach. And Michelle was actually at that work group last week, I believe, Wednesday, I think. And so we'll also be putting together a grant for that as well, where we wanted to put together some educational resources to really just help homeowners and HOAs be able to know how to maintain their stormwater facilities. From everything I've heard from Carrie Armstrong, who does our inspections, and just from all the other permittees, that's one of the major challenges. Is a lot of money is spent on these stormwater facilities. It's given responsibility by an HOA. Those homes in the HOA change ownership. Somebody buys a house. They didn't buy a stormwater facility. They don't know that they're responsible for this, but in actuality, they are. And so, they don't necessarily even know what their responsibility are, let alone how to be responsible by maintaining it the correct way. And so clarifying a lot of that and, having videos about the different assets within a stormwater facility and how to actually do the maintenance in simple terms that give people, basically empower people to be able to do it themselves, and also give people an understanding of, what that thing even is at the corner of their street and why it's important. And so incorporating an element of stewardship and stewardship recognition for neighborhoods and people that do maintain their stormwater facilities, as well as having a record log, a maintenance log that can be transferred to many different municipalities and permittees to be able to help people through that process, and basically just to keep a record of what's been done, because, you know, a lot of times if these things get neglected, the HOA, you know, they get notified, hey, your facility didn't pass, hasn't been maintained for a long time, now you end up having to pay more, you know, paying a little bit of catch-up, where, you know, proper maintenance would have prevented a lot of costs later on the line and helped with water quality as well. So that's the other grant that we'll be putting together. Both these grants are due next Friday, so that's what I'll be looking at those.
Thank you.
That's what I've got.
Do you have any contacts with the
homes? We don't have a whole lot of contacts for them yet. Do you?
Once I locate that article, Eric, can I go over and just go ahead and shoot that over to you?
Absolutely.
Can you look over and see this one?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
They'd be interested in that part with the HOA. It's a presentation that last year where QL community had tried to put a whole series of developments in where they had individual wells curbside, and they were requiring the homeowners to maintain it. And watching the presentation, I was like, and they had such a headache with it that after about 4 years, they ended up painting them all in.
Wow.
And directing them. So it ended up being a huge expense for the city and the developers and hassle for
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other aspect. You know, when we say stormwater facility, we're kind of using it very broadly to also incorporate low-impact development that might be just on a specific individual lot. Mm-hmm. And so that would also be something a little bit more similar to what you're talking about, too. It is a big challenge because people are buying a house. They're not buying a stormwater facility.
But it's really just, it's just an area of wetland where the water gathers. So it's really just, you know, picking up the garbage around it. Isn't that right? Notifying somebody when the water doesn't gather?
Yeah, I mean, it varies based on what the type of stormwater facility practice is.
Yeah.
that's the important part of being able to tell people and convey that message, what exactly to do, you know?
Yeah, along with, as we got to talking about it, a lot of the work, what's printed is very technical, or even video. And that's, so you have to sort of get over that hurdle. You have to make it more hands-on and for the people. And I've had a little bit of success, but not a tremendous amount of success at identifying like a peer review group, focus group that would look at the materials as they were being drafted down. You know, I don't understand that at all, or, you know, And so that it could be really key to, you know, so people really understand it.
I think the last thing you
want to
do is is kind of throw your hands up and, you know, say it doesn't matter, you know, kind of give up.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you want a case study, you know, all you really need to do is look at Houston. Houston in the last few weeks, you know, anybody been to Houston? You know, they do a terrible job with stormwater control. There's no place for the water to go. There's, you know, there's concrete everywhere. And they, well, not everywhere, but they just almost. And so they, so this stuff is important. And so I think it's really as hard as this work is, I think it's something you really got to keep focused on, because it's important. And you only find out about it when it's, when the stores are flooded.
Right? Well, even last year here, you know, when we had 30% more precipitation than the normal year, there are lots of examples.
I think the big part is, you know, bridging that gap and giving them the familiarity and appreciation for it, because for a lot of owners or developers, where it just becomes that thing that they have to do to meet a requirement, or they lose all of it, it's getting past that.
That's why we think that part of, you know, incorporating an element of stewardship recognition, hopefully will help to do that. And we also want to pick a couple of model stormwater facilities that can, you know, illustrate what the best practices are and really show people if they want to see firsthand, you know, exactly what is this thing, and how is it helping our community, how is it helping something that, you know, if you ask most people, do you want clean water, they say yes, it's then, you know, getting them to realize steps that are required to get there and get the buy-in on that side too.
And for the LIEs, especially in the recent years, there's been a lot of improvement in the materials that go into it and the vegetation that goes into it, so it's not as much of a maintenance problem as maybe 10 years ago.
So yeah, that case in Chihuahua was like they tried to take individual planted sediment and taking biosoils for each house to put people responsible for them. And like, if I was on the front end watching it before the presentation finished, I knew how to do it. So that way.
But it would be, I think, maybe a little beneficial if it was more like a community garden ideal, because it is just an open space. You know, if they could, you know, if there were ideas for them that they could add to it or take away, you know, just so it was more like a community thing instead of just a spot that was fenced off. That might help.
Yeah.
As a homeowner, I'd want to say, like, what can I do? Can I add to it? Can I, you know, can we need rocks over here? But that's, it's been about a homeowner, of course, but.
Any other comments? Well, working group updates, research presentation.
Okay, so I guess I'll introduce Jeff. The research group met with Jeff, Andrea, and Dean last month. Again, to kind of talk about the process that we're undergoing with the capital planning procedure, and we really focused this last meeting on the concept of a reserve. It's sort of operating reserve for the county to kind of manage, you know, large investments or large unplanned investments or even planned investments, but really focused mostly on kind of unplanned required maintenance or removal or replacement of assets that require replacement. Last meeting we talked about the fact that the county is managing about $100 to $110 million capital of infrastructure, and each of those elements have about a 30-year lifespan. And so you do the basic math and you see that we really need to be spending roughly $3 million a year on replacing those assets so that we don't have some large replacement cost at some point downstream here. And in fact, when you look at the budget, we're spending much less than $3 million on it. So we're seeing ourselves developing a little bit of a hole where we have some, we can expect to have some unplanned expenditures in the future that could really eat into the actual operating budget. So a reserve is something that we're probably going to have a lot of interest in. And I think what we'd like to do is the research group, we probably have another month's worth of work on it, but I think we'd like to make a recommendation to this committee probably next meeting, really focused in on what our recommendation to you guys will be in terms of what the reserve ought to be. And I think at that point, I think we'll let you decide what the process is going forward. We do have a straw dog draft presentation. We've kind of talked a little bit about it. I think what we want to do now is start getting more input from not only the research committee, but then also the county folks, and get some kind of reality checks to it before we go too much further and present it to you guys. So with that, I think what we'd like to do now is kind of roll it into this whole capital planning process that we started a couple meetings ago. We've worked with the county, and we've categorized the capital projects in kind of A, B, C formats. A formats are repairs and kind of required small repairs that go on and on. You know, B projects are the projects that take a little bit more planning. They have more than $25,000. It can be major repairs or replacements of assets. These projects can be, they're required, they're non-discretionary, but the timing of the project, if you guys recall, the timing of those projects can be somewhat discretionary, so that's why they're in a little different categorization. They're category B. They're projects that must be done, but they can be deferred until the next biennium. It's kind of how you think about that. And then we have the category C projects, which are improvement-related, clearly discretionary, but they're the right things to be doing so long as we're working on the right things. And so what we want to do now for the group tonight is to let Jeff explain some of the projects that are the current priorities for the county. And then going forward, what we'd like to do is to, in our partnership and communication efforts, to provide input to the county for the six-year planning process, so we get more of a community input into the long-term improvement projects. With that, Jeff.
Sounds like a plan. Well, thanks for having me back. I'm going to pass out. We're going to low tech tonight. But this is just a printout of the information Mark was just sort of reviewing about the categories that are important with, and I'll probably be referring to this repeatedly. So okay, this is going to be there. Can you hear me? Okay, all right. I kind of want to do a couple things that Mark and I had talked about, and I'll maybe go into a little bit more detail, kind of review on that A, B, and C category thing, just so we all are on the same page. Talk about primarily kind of that C category going forward, and then, as Mark mentioned, talk a little bit about kind of what the county's been thinking about as some priorities at this point, within this kind of framework, and then basically be inviting you all to be helping us to determine what those priorities might be going forward. So, real quickly, the maintenance and operations category A, right? That's our ongoing maintenance program. We talked a lot about that last time. So you saw all the graphs showing the incredible spike in assets that we're receiving from private development, things like that. We're currently spending about $2 million a year on that work. We're expecting that to continue to go up. So that will be a continuing kind of drain on the budget. When you get to category B, there's really almost, in reality, there's kind of a category B and a category B.5, in that the capitalized maintenance, the stuff that Mark referred to, where we need to repair things that are broke, that cost more than $25,000 to fix. Those are capitalized maintenance as well as replacing things. We also place in that kind of non-discretionary spending category monies we need to spend for projects to meet our permit. So we have to spend a certain amount of money, we have to build things, we have to purchase things, and we can do a lot of different kinds of projects beyond simply repair to meet that requirement in our permit. But we put that all in kind of category B, and that's also where I think we had talked about probably things like the reserve fund will be also housed in B as a non-discretionary thing. Pay yourself first. It's like when you put away your savings out of your paycheck before you go out and buy a new Nintendo game. I don't even know if Nintendo's the game now. It's probably Xbox or something else, right? But pay yourself first. So that's kind of part of B. That's non-discretionary. We have to do that, or we should be doing that. Right now, we're programming on the order of about $1.5 million a year. So for the six-year plan that we're playing around with right now, I'm kind of shooting for 1.5 to 1.8 as my target capital program per year on average. It doesn't have to be every year, but over the 6 years, about 1.5 plus to address category B. Category C then is the more the discretionary, the projects that do one of two things. They are either the same kind of projects as B, but over and above our requirements, right? So just more of good things. Or they can be certain types of projects that we don't, that have no permit nexus for us. They're not projects that we can use, like if I'm going to replace a culvert for fish passage or do a habitat improvement project in a stream. We can do those kinds of projects, but they don't give us any credit under the state permit, under the NPDES permit. So those are truly discretionary in that, we're just doing those things because they're good.
And just real quick on that, the 1.5 and 1.8, yep. Not with the reserve yet.
That is not including a reserve. Right? Yeah, there's no reserve in there.
The 6-year span.
That's per year.
Per year.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I think it'd be very interesting to actually get the data around this, but you know, an anecdotal kind of review of the list of projects that are being done under that category, very few of them are really replacements of assets.
Pretty much not.
So there's a lot of larger repairs, and so I think it's there's kind of an awakening, or there needs to be a little bit of an awakening here that we have an issue you keep kicking the can down the road, or we start to deal with it. But there's at some point, you know, there needs to be some thought process that goes in and just kind of structurally start to replace some of these aging assets.
Absolutely.
You just can't wait till they break.
Yeah, so there's a couple gaps. Right now, even in our B, you know, our non-discretionary, doesn't include any money for that, which, you know, depending on how aggressive we want to be with it, could be $1 million, it could be $3 million, as Mark said. You know, there's room to at least explore what we might want to start doing as far as an ongoing replacement of our oldest, most vulnerable assets. And we do have, as we talked about last time, a number of them that are already 30 to 45 years old. In the next 10 years, we're going to have a few hundred that are in that category, so we should probably start thinking about it soon. Or even earlier than now, probably. But so, second piece, the current capital plan that we're coming to the last 2 years of, 17 and 18, our last 2 years of the existing capital plan, in that capital plan, there's really almost nothing that I would categorize as category C. There's really no discretionary projects in their improvement projects, largely because for most of that 6-year period, we were in some unfortunate budgetary revenue circumstances. We also had pretty clear directives from our leadership that our approach was to be minimalistic, and that meant we will do the minimum required to meet the permit, and that is all. Zero more. So a couple of things have changed. That leadership has changed, and that outlook has changed. And so we are now much more flexible in being able to, you know, approach some of these projects that aren't flat required under the permit, but are good things to do. We get good bang for the buck. We can look forward, stop kicking the can, those kinds of things. So we have an opportunity there. And then the second thing, obviously, is we have a better revenue situation now than we had a few years ago. So we're actually able to potentially spend a little more money than the minimum. Okay. So those two things together, I think, you know, as we go into this six-year plan, we should have some opportunities to really, you know, we're not rolling in money, but we have money to at least explore some things and maybe see if we can make a dent, you know, in some ways that we haven't. So that's part two. So there's really very little of C right now. But going forward, so some of the things that I'm thinking about, or Dean and I or other staff have been thinking about as far as priorities for the 19 through 24 period, this upcoming 6-year slot, for the moment, we've been focusing on 2019 and 2020. Those are the first 2 years of the new plan, and we will probably be back in this room talking with the council about those 2 years worth of projects in about 2 months. I guess somewhere around the end of October, maybe, depending on scheduling, just to give them an idea of where we're heading for those first 2 years. And in large part because of the timing and also because of some of the existing needs that we have, we're currently focusing most of the effort in that 19 and 20 period on Category B. So I think right now that I've probably got enough existing capitalized repair projects, those ones that are greater than 25,000, to fill up, you know, better than a year's worth of budget for this type of work, you know, $1 to $1.5 million. But we're not going to just do those. We have a few other holdover projects, some high priority projects from the earlier plan that we weren't able to build that I would like to stick in there, kind of get those going. And then I think there's actually a little bit of room, not a whole lot of room, not so much because there's not opportunity, but because things take some time to develop. So for the 2019 year, it might be a little hard to get much of the improvement level, the Category C stuff going. But there are a couple things that I'm currently proposing that we had thought of as Category C, one of which is to throw a little bit of money, $150,000, $200,000, in the 2019 year towards what we call focused drainage basin planning. So going into a high priority area like some of the lower Salmon Creek tributaries like Suds Creek or Cougar Creek, you might be familiar with those, highly developed, not much room, but there's a lot going on in there, and it's difficult for us to sort of cherry pick out projects to make a difference in those areas. We think that it will be more efficient to throw some planning dollars at those areas and really look at them from top to bottom and say, okay, what are we going to do with this thing instead of what do we do with this property or this facility? Kind of plan them all together, and then going forward we can sort of build that into the capital plan, the construction end of things. Yes?
So I'm a little, I'm new to the capital planning.
Mm-hmm.
So is it like a big group of you guys? I mean, do you guys take a general consensus of your peers when you guys have decided to go forward on a project that it is the best way to use the money, best way to take care of the problem?
Yeah, it's all internal at the moment. I mean, this interaction between us and you is sort of the only thing that's not internally staff-driven at this point. But we do have, and I should send that.
Yep.
I don't remember that here. Maybe send out the work plan basically for the planning process. So everybody has that. But essentially, I'm the lead for the project, but there is a group of four or five engineers, and then a permitting specialist, who are the technical team that is working on scoping projects and determining which are the priority based on kind of cost benefit and feasibility analysis, things like that, from this large list of possibles that we have. And then we have a group of upper level managers who help us with the final packaging of the program by being kind of a vetting group. And so we'll sit around with the projects that have kind of floated at the top, and we'll just sit around a table like this and basically nitpick them and see if we can't find fatal flaws and basically try to be as negative as we can and try to kill projects and try to figure out things that would really cause problems later, because these are usually complicated. When we're trying to retrofit things or squash things in where there's no room, they're very, very difficult to design successfully. So we kind of play with them a little bit and then come up with a final. But thanks for bringing that up, because I forgot that nobody knows what the plan is. My secret plan.
I think part of the process is to how much value does a capital project add?
Yeah.
So part of what we can do is to provide some input on what that value is. You know, there's interest in the community to do certain things that benefit kind of a large association or whatever, then you need to know that. And so to the degree we can provide you that information, then that's that just adds some kind of reality to the project, to the process.
And I know we're always looking for some way to kind of measure what it is that we've done or which way we're going, if anything that we've done has actually made a difference. Was it the Whipple Creek? It was one of the largest spending projects coming up. And it was to be kind of just a new vulnerable wetland or something like that, kind of a natural area. At one of these projects, I was thinking possibly if to Amanda Lake, so that way all of the water, if it was one of the larger areas that we're looking to redo, it just naturally will gather the water. It can become a public access area. It gives us a way to kind of monitor the constant flow of water that's coming into this large area, so I could benefit
both sides of the coin and probably give a good measure.
Sometimes there are opportunities for those kind of large flagship projects. We've never tried a lake necessarily, but and that would be tough.
Small lake.
It would be tough. But there are potential places where we could work towards those kinds of projects, and that's a good segue into part three. But I want to get to Michelle really quick before we go there.
Yes. So, as you were talking about Suds Creek and Cooper Creek, so what you're, if I can sort of paraphrase, you're looking at it like an integrated systems view of those basins, so that instead of sort of stovepipe project by project, you're looking at how they all fit together, and that way you can also better identify the bang for the buck in terms of where it is in that and what could be done maybe quickly,
that's
not that expensive,
that
could have.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think there's two other things. One, we can potentially, like Holly was saying, if we do focus some resources on a fairly small drainage area, we may actually be able to make enough difference that we can do some monitoring that kind of shows a difference down the line. It, oftentimes it's very, very difficult, especially with projects that are spread all over the place, to really say, you know, quantitatively how much difference it made. I mean, we know they make a difference. We trust that they do based on the research and the literature, but if you want to actually measure a difference in your stream, it's kind of tough. So, but we may be able to do that if we put a bunch of projects in one spot. And then also it's an opportunity, I think, that Jane and Eric and I have talked about some, because if we go in and start doing kind of focused capital projects in some of these smaller basins, we can also use that as an opportunity to kind of hit those areas with our whole program, right? Not just capital, but we can also do outreach, and we can do pet waste, and we can do, you know, all those other things in kind of a holistic way, which I think would be kind of fun, one, and I think could be very effective, second. Can't do that to the exclusion of the rest of the county, though, so, you know, I can't spend all of our money in Cougar Creek for 3 years when, you know, the rest of the folks around the county are paying the bills, so... There is a balance in there, but we will work on it.
I'm a little concerned about C being called discretionary, because if you can show a difference, you know, which is, a lot of people are asking about that. We'll talk more about that, you know, later on in the meeting tonight, but that is really key. It may not be a checkbox in the permit, but it certainly is the intent of the Clean Water Act.
Very correct, yeah. And so my bad for continuing to use that word. Mark and Jeremy have been coaching me against that word, but
yeah.
They're just not coaching me well enough.
Those just showing up in the
These are
the add value. There's no hammer out there just kind of bashing you to do those kinds of things. And so, but they're the right things to do if you can do them. So that's kind of what that's.
Yeah, which is why the term improvement is really the what we should be using. So keep reminding me.
A good point too is our conversation about the elected officials to approve your reserve.
Yes.
You have the term discretionary in there. That's like.
Oh. You can ignore that.
If I have a discretionary budget and I ask somebody for money, to help with my discretionary.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's a tough ask that way. Yeah. Yep. Very good. So really quickly, I don't want to take too much of your time here tonight, but the piece that I think for these improvement projects. That I think we'd really like some input, and I know you all are going to be kind of approaching HOAs and neighborhood associations, I guess more so than HOAs probably, but some members of the public to get some insight, and I know you all have some insights as well. Those kinds of projects, certainly within the middle to end of that 6-year plan that we're working on, I think that's where our opportunity is. The types of projects that you might want to, you know, consider. I mean, there's lots. I mean, I just jotted down a couple that I think are cool. Things that I would love to do more of if it was entirely my call. I think we get more bang for the buck from in-stream projects oftentimes than we do from up here on the upland or in a facility. So we're talking about, you know, channel spanning log jams and floodplain reconnection and, you know, more of these kind of process-based watershed process enhancement or rehabilitation stuff. Those can be good projects. Those are the ones we don't get any credit for under the permit. So those are entirely extra improvement, right? Property acquisition, sometimes the best deal is to you know, grab up property in areas that are not messed up already, right? And hold it and save it, right?
Yeah.
That can be done. We have the ability to do that kind of stuff. And this is what Holly was getting at. I had written down large multi-use projects. We used to call them flagship projects. You've probably seen some of these around on tours with folks. Thomas Wetland East is one of them, where there's a, you know, walking trail and it's adjacent to a park, so it's providing some public benefit, and it's a waterfowl area, and as well as being a flood control and a treatment area, right? So those are really expensive. Those are multi-million dollar projects. They do not fall out of the sky very often. They take quite a bit of work to find and make happen. They take time. They take lots of permitting. But they can be really good. Those are move-the-needle type of projects, right? You put a thing like that up in the headwaters and restore the headwaters or something. You can do a lot of good. But, you know, that's an area we could expand into. Those were just three that I wrote down that I like. But what we want is for you guys to, you know, let us know what you'd like to see. So,
yeah. You were just touching on the notion of walking paths. And I'm a fairly regular attendee of the Regional Transportation Commission.
I'm sorry.
Yes, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. But they have projects that are similar, but they're not focused as much on the stormwater aspects. So there may be opportunities for partnering
leverage
with the RTC folks.
Mm-hmm.
To gain access to some funding, because they're doing things like putting in bike paths and putting in walking trails and some of those kinds of things. They're not as focused on stormwater particularly, but they could be dovetailed next to those kinds of projects. And I think that they have some projects currently that are being considered on the list.
Is that a list of projects that's
available? Project as well.
Yeah, that'd be great to look at that actually and see what they've got. See if there's any possibilities. That's really the way we do most of our any kind of acquisition projects we have right now are typically leveraged through the Legacy Lands program that the county also has. And so it's a separate pot of money, but we can often, you know, leverage a little bit of stormwater funding with some of that money to get a little bit larger hunk of property, and then it's set aside. So, yeah, leveraging and partnerships is really helpful. So. Yeah, help me remember to check in.
It's more leveraging and partnering within the county as opposed to outreach to other, you know, organizations.
Sure.
Like what we normally are doing with the stormwater departments. So there's a differential there. Because at some point or another, the conversation is going to get in front of the Board of Councilors. And they're going to be making decisions about where they want to allocate resources. And that sort of rolls into the question that I was going to ask is that, you know, if it's called a reserve, how likely is the Board of Councilors going to want to put money into something that you're calling a bank account? And you're banking it for later use. Right? They may not be as tuned into wanting to do that. Because we're all, to a certain extent, resource constrained.
stormwater response fund.
The county website did find kind of what you brought last time, which was the breakdown of the projects. And it said future projects, but it didn't have what you brought us. Is there a different place that I should be looking for that? Is that public record? Was that a pronouncement?
I don't know. Where were you looking?
Yeah. It was a stack paper that you brought. It was just a list of all the future kind of projects, kind of, you know, the counties and every section, what you kind of break down what you guys have planned.
That was the 2013-18 list, I think. Okay. And that one should be out there somewhere. The new one's not.
So you want to look at that one for the ideas going forward?
As far as just general ideas, you could refer to that, but for the most part, that's past.
That is past.
Yeah.
So, if you were going to look at some other approaches, and this is along the line of, you know, buying up parcels, except that it's not buying up necessarily a total parcel, but looking at a limited ecosystem services trade market kind of thing, which would, you know, for a discrete watershed, you might be able to do a trial of some sort that would protect, you know, sort of sources and protect part of the watershed advance, but in parallel with, you know, the development of areas. So is that something that could go into this? It would be, could also be, receive grant funding from a number of different sources, because you'd have to have significant amount of sort of seed money.
Yeah.
Is that something that might go here?
I don't know. It's possible that could fit, yeah. What was the term for the
arrangement? Ecosystem services.
Ecosystem.
Trading or credit market.
Okay.
And in this case, it would focus, you know, mostly on stormwater and water quality.
And if I'm following you, there is a development regarding that plan.
Well, wetlands and streams, but, you know, so it's broader than wetlands. You can do it, apply it to stormwater as well.
But different than a banking, like a straight banking.
It's different from banking.
Yeah, it's not a mitigation bank or something.
No, it's really, although, you know, sort of credits do accumulate, essentially, in terms of these protected areas or these services provided. And then their practices really almost more than implementing concrete infrastructures.
Sure. Soft engineering.
Are you guys able to do that, to do a project that might also get outside grant funding? Does it increase the habitat of something, the salmon, or whatever the topic might be?
Yeah. We typically, as far as grants that we've routinely applied for in the past, we're typically going for the Stormwater Financial Assistance Program through Ecology, but there's some other ones out there that, you know, various fish-related grants. Even the Lower Columbia Fish Recovery Board, you have that kind of stuff. Some of it with our money.
Well, there was money on that land picking, because it was a big thought for me. I mean, my own input at some point would be the development of natural systems that are working for you. Because my own piece that I could fish a lot and work is the more you can integrate these natural systems to do the work for you, so that that's not a long-term cost. And particularly bigger areas like you're mentioning Thomas Wetland or some of the other sites around the county, like Curtin Creek, where you have a large enough area that the maintenance is relatively minimal. There's not as much of an infrastructure that you have to maintain over the long term. So they might be very expensive up front, but over the long term, we basically create a natural area that care of this whole water cleaning filtration force without having a long-term extent. And I'd be interested in being able to present this over the long, you know, when we're eventually trying to approach getting the funds. The two areas I was trying to end up on would be one with that, if you had some type of diagram that could show, okay, putting one of these projects that comes to land together might cost us X million dollars, but it takes input from this much space. If we were running it through, say, this type of system, a facility type system that required maintenance every 15, 20, 30 years, that would cost us this much.
So it's a big upfront cost, but over the long run, these investments are really going to save the county.
Yeah.
And then the other part I didn't know is that a big picture that you're taking, which I think is fantastic, where you're trying to look like, as opposed to cherry picking projects, like if I tweak these things here, we can take the impact off of this critical area. I didn't know if there's a breakdown too that's easy to extrapolate of the costs of those for you guys to be able to say, like, these are some smaller ones, these are some more expensive ones, and how to prioritize those in that way to kind of get an idea on it. And I think kind of in a way to present, if you were trying to talk to the counselors about funding a reserve fund, you could say, if these two pieces went right here, that would cost us $3 million to repair that. So if you had an event and the infrastructure went out, these points here that affect this whole community, then that would cost us much to repair. As an example for them to think about, like, having that money on hand.
No, that's a really good idea to have some examples and visuals for them to try. Well,
right. So you just throw it like, you say, I'd like to have $3 million on reserve, but yeah. if we could show them, like, if this facility went, that affects this whole community,
yeah.
and to repair that,
yeah.
would be $1.5 million.
The reserve discussion almost takes a whole separate meeting.
It does.
I mean, it's separate topic, because there's a lot of ideas around that. So it sounds, Jeff, like you have a process going on right now. You're developing a six year planning process, and I think what we need to do is to get kind of our arms around the projects that are in that list,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll kind of do that going forward. But I think you need some time to A, develop a list, and B, get some approval around those things.
Yeah, I can definitely give you right away kind of the existing list of potential projects that we're currently looking at, right? That doesn't mean they're the only ones out there, but that's the ones we have in the database, right? And which category they would fall into, which ones are C, like only C, and which ones could go B or C, that kind of stuff. So that's pretty much available right now. It's probably in a language only I understand at the moment, but I can probably make it. I showed some of it to Andrea today, and she went, no. So I'll the next couple of weeks I can certainly have something like that to you guys, so you can kind of start playing with, see if the things that are in there are the things that kind of fit with what you're hearing from folks or what you're thinking yourselves, and that'll help us to sort of mash things up. So, right. Anything else? I don't know if that hits what you wanted to talk about, but
right. Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you, Jeff.
Do you have any links
about the
echo?
This is great. Yeah.
Yes.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
The article.
I'll send them to you, and then you can send them out.
Okay. I'm running a little late, but it's an interesting discussion. So I didn't know about it. Anything from the communication?
Good job, research, by the way.
We would love to have people inviting us out so we could come and talk to them about the requirements of the stormwater systems. I think if Eric has an opportunity or hears anything, groups that might want to have us come and visit, we'd love to do some partnering with him and relieve some of the work on his plate.
That's what the school is.
Have yet to meet outside of this meeting. I know a couple ideas were tossed around earlier about the big corporations, versus the going with the school. That was kind of perfect timing, I thought, with Andrew's PowerPoint presentation. It kind of gives us something to start with the Washington Green School being so big. That was kind of like, where do we start? So I know I'm looking forward to getting with Michelle and and kind of getting a kind of attack on where we're going to go first at that, but it gives us a lot better of a target to shoot towards. So thank you. But.
So, we're just going to, you know, get together and answer the questions and help with the Clean Water Division. Mr. Stubbs, questions? So, if you had time to look at that, because Henry was going to do it. Number four, some input about what we'd like to see, which is that complex on the projects.
Well, I think Jeff just outlined a number of projects that were on his interest list. He spoke specifically.
Jeff's responses actually are in here, and not necessarily from tonight, but from earlier. His input is in here.
Some of it is in there.
So are your comments with respect to in-stream projects and processes, property acquisition, and large multi-use projects with perhaps walking paths, those kinds of things, those reflected here?
Partially. I think the property part was reflected, and then I think I limited it to that.
So I wasn't clear to me whether it was an either or between response one or response two. Was that what it was?
No, it's just a wish.
Okay. I think it's different individuals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I looked at it, I thought, you know, clearly the things under response one are, you know, would be preferred in terms of the first and second priority, and then the response two is sort of a third priority, and then there's a fourth, or I don't know if it's actually prioritized like this for the fourth bucket, which is sort of the maintenance education that Eric talked about, what he's doing. And I think a number of the projects, kinds of projects and approaches that we just talked about, what we were doing in that category C, should be somehow captured in here. I'm not sure we need to rehash all of it, but you know, I think they could be captured in here. If I could add something, you know, a wish list, you know, so when I look at the water cycle, you know, all the outreach and stuff that we try to do is so fabulous. But I just touched on earlier, this is sustainability for the future. On my wish list would be, you know, being able to get with large corporations that really have, you know, with one move, make a massive, you know, play in our watershed cycle, whether it just be a parking garage or a, you know, just one facility. So I would hope that we could, on some level, have some kind of say on the type of material that they use and
one of the things I didn't see in here as I went through is, you know, they also talked last meeting about having a kind of an ongoing representation with this group. Is that, should we mention that in this response? That, because it sounds like it feels to me like they're asking for kind of a relationship. Some of these questions are really targeted at how do you maintain an ongoing dialogue, which is what it's the same group we were talking about last meeting. I mean, one of us or two of us go to these meetings on a regular basis. I think they meet bi-monthly, is that, or something? We value their input, and that our objective is to.
Partner.
think, too, going back to what David was pointing out, we can pull in more of what Jeff said tonight and figure out. So.
In subsequent discussions in the meeting, in groups, in the group meetings.
Yeah.
That's kind of the tone. That's the kind of direction I think we're trying to shoot for.
Yeah.
I think I learned some lessons. You know, I went to one of these folks' meetings and with the idea that maybe we could kind of get into a discussion on infrastructure and capital expenditures, and you just can't do it in a one meeting. It's just like I was sitting there thinking, how do we have this discussion? And there's no way to do it. You really have to partner with them. You have to understand what their needs are. You have to have kind of an ongoing dialogue. I think that's what this is all about. You know?
Yeah, because you can't just pound out your idea.
Right.
I hope somebody sends you an email. And they won't. It's hard to educate someone who might need it.
Right, exactly.
And I wonder, too, because this is in Google Docs, so I don't know whether you want to even open it up, but if people want to see revising. To it. It can be shared with everyone.
I think it's an excellent set of responses. There's a couple of tweaks there that I've made to it, but I think you're there. It's far better to respond quickly with good input to kind of lengthen out the input process and get better results.
Yeah, I number 8 seemed to be, and maybe it was because it was the last one, but it seemed as though it needed a little bit more, could have had something of a pilot program, downstop disconnect program. And then, the part about why there's a difference between Portland and Clark County is sort of like, what is the significance of that then? Well, in Portland, yeah, it's actually the focus of a lawsuit that they have to minimize the flow into the sanitary sewers, the combined sewer system. And in Clark County, it's still important from the standpoint of storm flow measurement to try to disconnect them. So I just thought we might need a little bit more out of it than that.
Okay.
That was one that I thought the response, the question, is this around why from the public side the interest in it? Our response was a little bit more just kind of background about it. He's clearly already aware of it. So, if we were able to do a little bit more with regards to the public side, then it seems like our one is being more out there that it was going on.
Right. And Marie and I talked about it, and we can flesh it out a little more, that since it is in schools, it's not really something that necessarily we get publicized, so we're kind of grappling with how do we portray that.
That's probably something that with the partnerships that we could possibly address as far as which schools kind of have it set and which schools we're going to kind of assist possibly, and then possibly get somebody here kind of tell us in an open meeting, this has to be Michelle, what they do, how they implement it, how they get involved. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Well, certainly there are a number of partners already that have come together, to put this on. The other avenue I can think of is that there's so much emphasis on STEM training and STEM activities and so forth, and there's a lot of buzz around that right now. It seems that you can elevate this on that same plane as a part of that kind of activity.
Well, and Brendan, specifically, since you've been an educator in the
staff mm-hmm. with the watershed conferences. What is your perspective?
I mean, it was kind of summarized here, and I guess his question was, you know, is it still around? And so my response was just like, yeah, it's not publicized enough because it has a limited budget that they can only reach so many students, so that they take their staff and figure out how many people they can access through that. And I'm not really aware currently how much leftover budget they have, if it's something that they can expand to more at this point. The big part, and I mean, it's really the one day that they could really use a lot of input from groups like our own, is when they do the Watershed Congress and they present, they want to have representatives from the community that the students present to, to provide them that feedback.
And this is the first year I participated for the first time, and it was unclear to me whether, you know, it was like a closed network that.
Yeah.
Or whether, and so maybe that's an opportunity for trying to spread the word more or some kind of publicity.
When does that come in?
Usually in the May.
Okay.
Yeah.
And and I was working here in May of 2016, but I hadn't been here very long and I wasn't able to participate and I didn't really know what it was. And it was interesting too because my children went through the Vancouver about this program. So it's just so interesting that you just have to be the right, you know, connected to the right people to actually get.
Yeah, it's kind of random.
Yeah.
So the demand is there, but the money's not there. Is that it?
At times, and again, like I'm not clear on what their current funding is. I know for a while it was a little bit of a balance act between the county funds and the city funds. And at least when I was doing it as an educator, we had to keep the two of those separate, so we could only bill so much to sort of limit how much we could do outside of the city. And what the two of them were willing to help each other out with. I believe currently the way the funding is now, it is pool. So the educators who are private contractors don't have to bill it separately. They're able to one pool of funding that they're operating from. When I was doing it, we had to like do this many county schools and then do this many city schools.
Okay.
And I don't believe that's an issue anymore. I don't know for sure. But you know, it was a certain amount of grant funding, and so then they figured how many educators they're going to have and how many students are going to be able to reach with that. And that again comes back to our issue we discussed earlier about the personality of teachers that really get involved and continue to get their students involved to the degree of how much. Some classes are getting out and having one or two visits. Ideally, what the program is designed for is to get them out to do multiple visits, optimistically four. If they want to do it monthly, that's awesome. So then the students are getting this snapshot over time of it and a little bit more picture. I know myself from being an educator, if you do one day out, it's like pat on the back or get the kids outside. But if you're able to do it six times over the course of a year, much more of a development of knowledge about what they're looking at.
And they can start to look at trends. And
exactly.
And start to connect some of the dots.
And originally it was designed to educate them around salmon habitat. The curriculum was really designed a lot around salmon. The metrics for water quality were based on salmon habitat. But we ran into the situation, this is something more of my personal anecdote, but we ran into a situation where students were going out and giving an in-class presentation on what's great with salmon habitat, but then they were going out and monitoring a bioswale. And you could make a connection that the bioswale is filtering the water and it goes into the system, but it was really hard to get a presentation on why salmon live in our local streams and then go test the bioswale. It's not a salmon habitat. So the program morphed a little bit at that point to adapt more. Okay, when you're talking about bioswale, wetland habitat, or we're talking about a stream that's feeding into the river. So they've been able to mold, the educators have molded it a little bit more to what the students are actually involved with that too. But yeah, it's still an active program. I'm happy that they do it. Maybe a lot of students involved.
Yeah, I was, when I went in May, a lot of students. It was just because it was at Washington State University of Vancouver, and I'm not quite sure how many were involved, but there were a lot, and it was just really exciting to be part of something that all of these students of various ages and then adults as either educators or parents or community members. It was a really cool experience.
and we'll have the document shared so we can get some reviews and edits and finalize. Okay, Whipple Creek Water System.
So we just want, I wanted to let you know that we completed the Whipple Creek Watershed Assessment. I don't know if you saw the, there was an article in the newspaper. We can pass it around if you want to look at it. So it was required as part of our permit, along with King County, Pierce County, and Snohomish County, we needed to perform this sort of assessment, and it described Whipple Creek's current degraded health. The parameters that were looked at were water temperature, heavy metals, and fecal coliforms bacteria. Computer models were used to measure the potential benefit of stormwater treatment facility and other strategies such as planting trees, and how that would affect the restoration of Whipple Creek. So Whipple Creek watershed, if you don't know, drains from the hills just east of I-5 near Washington State University, Vancouver, and flows west to Lake River.
Maybe I should have you.
The Clark County drafted the assessment to identify strategies that, if put in place, would support the state's designated uses for the creek, such as fish and wildlife habitat, recreation, and aesthetics. Fully restoring Whipple Creek's designated uses to state standards would cost more than $300 million. Clark County does not envision spending that amount, but the assessment will help the county rank practical, measurable improvements for Whipple Creek, which flows into the capital planning that we're talking about. So, if anyone has any questions.
Do you think that was an accurate assessment? Do you
think so? Yes.
I'm not sure if it's accurate. It's in the ballpark. For certain. It is outlandish. It also is a reflection of the requirements of the project that we had from ecology, right? So If we were of our own volition going to go out and look at Whipple Creek and do a stormwater master plan or something, you know, of that nature, we would have slightly different sideboards that we would probably apply and shoot for than what ecology requires us to do in this process. So the numbers are just, I mean, they're astronomical, and they're, you know, they're based on the fact that really the only way to meet the goal that ecology set for this thing is to take all the houses that are there and get rid of them and put big stormwater retention ponds in place of them. So relatively unreasonable steps, right? But if you do that, you can spend $350 million because you're knocking down houses and you're buying all that property because you're displacing all these people and you're doing, you know. So it adds up very, very quickly when you do that. So in a realistic sense, you wouldn't pursue that kind of a program. But like Andrew was saying, the goal that, our secondary goal, first we have to check that box for the permit. We have to do that project. But our hope is to use those modeling outputs and that information that we learned about to actually try to, you know, help ourselves focus types of projects that maybe move the needle more than other types within the model. The locations that looked like they responded most readily to inputs from our program, We can use that kind of information to kind of build into our capital plan. Where can't do it all, obviously, not even close, right? But we can do something, and this type of a tool helps us to do the somethings in the best locations that will do the most, if that makes any sense. So, yeah.
I would say to overgeneralize, we use the 80-20 rule, but the fact is that you probably can get a majority of the benefits for a fraction of that spending.
Right.
So it's identifying those little nuggets that you can get that get the majority of the benefits.
And I know
I just wondered, is there a TMDL on
Google Play? There's no existing TMDL. There are listings on the 303D, so there will eventually, someday, be.
In talking to Rod Swanson, our program manager for permit compliance, that he said there were a couple different things that were found from the model. One of which is you can't restore a forest to the hydrology if you can't use LID. And so if there's clay soil, then it's not going to infiltrate, so it's not going to work. Shading the stream meets water quality criteria, or helps meet water quality criteria. And then the dissolved copper and zinc would fall within the standards of the state. And then we would be unable to meet the bacteria standards for various reasons, such as you can't infiltrate the runoff, which would be really the main way to treat bacteria and the fecal coliform. And then there are lots of natural sources of it, such as beavers and birds.
Did they do any analysis of the sources of the fecal?
No, this didn't. This was entirely we collected grab samples and that kind of stuff just to characterize, but there wasn't any source control type of tracking.
Oregon has just beefed up their beaver population and pretty much saved a whole bunch of money.
They can store a lot of water.
They
are pretty amazing.
Check our beaver population.
Yeah. Whipple Creek has a lot of beavers. It would be in much worse shape, actually, if there were other beavers.
And they create
lockdown. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same stuff, but we would go in and engineer them, right?
Yeah.
And stick them in the lake.
And they're really good at repairing and maintaining this. They're really good at that.
Yeah.
But that's just another engineer.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see the breakdown on costs. I've seen project proposals that. And we're going to throw $2 million at watering it.
Right.
Well, I think since next Monday is the Neighborhood Association meeting, Mark made a big point. If you could get your comments back by Monday morning, I'll have been meeting and hand the Mr. Stokes the responses. Any public comment? Any other items that the commission would like to bring up as a group to discuss?
I have a couple things that nobody else has anything.
Go ahead.
I was going to also update everyone just on the status of the county manager. So at this point, the Board of County Councilors have approved a contract to work with Strategic Government Resources for an executive search for a new county manager. So that's basically where that. That they approved the contract as of August 15th, so it's been a couple of weeks. And I know they've held a number of work sessions as well on the roles and attributes of a county manager. they're in the process. And I just wanted to give a heads up, so the next meeting will be the November meeting, and it's going to be the last meeting of the calendar year. So one of the things you'll want to start thinking about is the annual report. And then also at the next meeting, you'll want to be nominating and electing your 2018 chair and vice chair. So just kind of putting that out there. And then so in the past we've done a field trip together. So I don't know if there is interest this year in doing a field trip, either end of September, early October. I can start putting together, we can start looking at people's schedule or trying to put dates together where people can do this. Typically we do it during Thursday, and that means not everyone can come, but usually people can come, so certainly if we need to work with timing, we can discuss that. But it looks like seeing head nodding that there's interest.
It was great to do last year.
Okay.
Yes,
no, we don't have anything specific yet. There were some different options that I was talking about. So, and even it can go beyond, like Michelle, you were saying that looking at a project in one of the schools potentially, or and I know last year we discussed even Washington State University, Vancouver. If there were ever an opportunity that we could go up there and tour what they're doing. But then certainly, Dean and I were also talking about not just stormwater facilities, but even possibly like monitoring activities if we were to go out with some of our staff that do that. So we wouldn't do everything, but it might be one of those. So, okay, so I'll start coordinating.
Motion to close.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Okay. Trustee Stein. Trustee Stein. Is that it? Ian.
Still great.